Today on Equestrian Legacy Radio, as we begin the 4th of July holiday, we're pleased to bring you an encore presentation featuring two talented women, Junie Fisher and Bobby Joe Lieberman. Today's show is brought to you by our great sponsors found in the General Store and the Gallery at East of Santa Fe. You'll find everything for the horse lover and folks that love the equestrian lifestyle in the Gallery at East of Santa Fe and the General Store at EquestrianLegacy.net. Enjoy today's show and have a safe and happy 4th of July.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is Equestrian Legacy Radio.
I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly jimson weed. I'm back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44, where you sleep out every night and the only law is right. Back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-o, rocking to and fro, back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-a, I go my way, back in the saddle again. I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly jimson weed. I'm back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44, where you sleep out every night and the only law is right. Back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-o, rocking to and fro, back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-a, I go my way, back in the saddle again.
You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio. I'm your host, Gary Holt, and we have an exciting show for you today. We have two great guests that are joining us. First of all, we'll have Junie Fisher, who is the Western Music Association 2011 Entertainer of the Year. And we also will be welcoming to the show Bobby Joe Lieberman, who is the managing editor of Trailblazer Magazine. So we have an exciting show. We look forward to our great conversation and great music. And when we come back, Junie Fisher will be joining us at the Campfire Cafe.
One little bird transcends its wings when by its nature begins to sing. Much like the poet with his poem transcends his station, his flesh and bone. It's who they are. The painter knows art how he shows what's in his heart. The horseman's touch through calloused hand whispers a bridge between horse and man. It's who they are. It's who they are. It's why they breathe. It's what they hear. It's all they see. It's how they're born. It's how they're made. It's not their choice. They have no say. It's who they are. And if God sends inspiration to share these gifts on earth, then who are we to wonder if those gifts have any worth? If not for them, where would we turn? They fill a need. When will we learn? They feed our souls. It's not their choice. They didn't ask to be our voice. It's who they are. And if God sends inspiration to share these gifts on earth, then who are we to wonder if those gifts have any worth? If not for them, where would we turn? They fill a need. When will we learn? They feed our souls. It's not their choice. They didn't ask to be our voice. It's who they are. It's who they are.
That's Junie Fisher's Who They Are, and a beautiful song, and we're so happy to have Junie join us today. Junie is the 2011 Western Music Association Entertainer of the Year, Female Performer of the Year, Song of the Year, and in 2012 she was True West Magazine's Best Solo Performer, and in 2013 she's nominated for 5 Western Music Association Awards. So, Junie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're just tickled to death to have you joining us, and I think you're out in California today, aren't you?
I am in California. It's beautiful and sunny, and the weather just couldn't be better.
Well, that's great, and I told you before the show started that when you got on the line, the sunshine came out here, so it'd been overcast all morning.
And you just, it's a good sign.
It's a good sign. You just brightened the day for us. You know, Junie, we have listeners that are in over 40 countries and across the United States, and our listeners are always interested in knowing the background of our guest as far as their horse activities mm-hmm. are concerned. And I know from talking with you the other day that you grew up privileged and your folks just gave you horses and provided everything.
Oh yeah, right. I worked for 3 or 4 summers saving my money And when I was 13, I had $300 saved up. And at first, my granddad helped me go look, but we looked at several different kinds of, you know, situations for horses, and then my dad went with me, and I ended up choosing a saddlebred mare of all things, but she was raised by a friend of my granddad's, and he was an old saddlebred breeder in Tulare, California. And back in the, there was a heyday when saddlebreds were big in really everywhere back in the 40s, and that guy was from back in that era. And
right.
Anyway, he still had some, and he had this three-year-old that was very gentle, had a good kind eye, and $300 was a lot of money. But I paid for my mare, and my dad helped me start her, and then I cleaned house for my grandma for every Saturday morning, and I got paid $2 to clean her house, and then I also could work in the summers, and that's how I made my money to go to 4-H horse shows, and I was on the little drill team and learned to show, and people would pull me aside and coach me and help me, and then I couldn't take lessons, but I could watch the kids that won, and I'd tuck myself in behind whoever was winning, and everything she did, I'd copy her.
Oh, that's great. That's great. That is great. Well, but that horse love has not faded, and I know that you had quite a career with horses.
Well, I did. In college, I figured out real quickly, and of course, you know, my parents were working class farmers, and we just didn't have that kind of money. And even if they had, they wouldn't have just thrown it at me. If I wanted to do that, it was up to me to figure out a way to do it. So I worked for people, and you know, I'd start colts, and then I'd take that colt to college with me, and do the classes at the college. We had a great horse program at the junior college I attended. And then while I was in college, I worked out a deal with our horse show team coach. He was a quarter horse exhibitor, and he had a really nice young mare that needed some mileage, and he also needed her to be shown in the hunt seat classes at the quarter horse shows. So he said, if you'll show her at the hunt seat classes, pardon me, in the hunt seat classes at quarter horse shows, you can use her for the college shows. Well, that was a win-win for me, because not only did I get to have a much nicer horse than I could have ever had for the intercollegiate shows, I got to go to quarter horse shows and show with the big boys.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So it was great. And so then I sort of became sort of the catch rider. If somebody needed something shown in a class and they knew it was a judge that particularly, you know, liked my style, they'd grab me and toss me on, and you know, you get 5 or 10 minutes to figure out whether this is a horse you can show, and they were always broke enough that, you know, you could get it done. And,
right.
And so I sort of made my way as a catch rider.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people have enjoyed having a little bit more horse than they might could afford by being able to do that.
It was great for me. And I was
great.
Versatile enough. I could learn something pretty quickly. So, you know, when I needed to learn to ride saddle seat, well, that was, you know, a couple of hours on one day, and the next day I was showing. Now, I'm not saying that anybody could just go ride saddle seat, but I had the basics, and
right.
I was very centered. And so I could show saddle seat. Well, then I would be at Arab shows, and somebody would grab me, and I'd go, you know, catch ride an English pleasure class. They said, "Do you have your saddle suit?" Yeah, I do. Well, go get it, because I got one for you to show. Oh, okay. And I'd come back.
Oh, so much fun. So much fun.
Yeah, I had a good time. It was really a great way to get a lot of riding in and a lot of experience in the show pen that I couldn't have done otherwise. And then I hung my own shingle for a while and started some colts, but I realized what I really needed to show cow horses was a deeper cow horse background, and I was tinkering with that, but what I really wanted to do was buckle down and really show the cow horses. So I went to work for a rein cow horse trainer that I knew, and I had loped some horses for him before, and he hired me, and that was when I really went to the School of Hard Knocks, but it was great. You know, I'd saddle and lope 10 or 12 a day for him, and then he would have sort of a secondary string of horses that he knew he wasn't going to show, and those would be in my string, and those were mine to get to work after I got done with his string, and it gave me a world of education.
Now, was this while you were in college, or was this after college?
This was after college. I'd gotten out of college, worked for a veterinarian. My uncle was a veterinarian. I worked for him for a couple years, and then decided what I really wanted to do was play cow horses and train. So I went to work for this trainer, and it was hard work, but boy, was it an education. And because of him, I also got to ride with other trainers who would come by and work cattle with us, or we'd go to their place, and I made some friends back in those days that have lasted all these years. We're talking about many, many years back, 25 years ago. So.
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, it's interesting. We talked to people. I had a gentleman on a few weeks ago that is a five-star Pirelli instructor, a David Litchman. And David grew up in the New England states and went to school with a degree in, I believe it was engineering. And then in his 30s, he decided that he wanted to make his living with horses. And so when you were in college, what were you going to school for?
Oh, I was pretty sure that I could make a living with horses and I didn't need any more education than that. the things of youth. And interestingly, now my horse show team coach and instructor in college, who was just great, he and his wife raised quarter horses, and they showed on the quarter horse circuit. But he also had a teaching degree,
okay.
And so and then I ran into him a couple years ago, and he had just retired from teaching at the junior college where I went to school. But I've just heard that he's recently taken a position going back to teaching, but at a bigger college and teaching their horsemanship program there. So lucky for them, because he was a great instructor.
Well, that's great. That's great. Well, so you train that way, and I know what other disciplines have you participated in? Because as we were talking the other day, you shared something I didn't know, and you ended up in East Tennessee.
I did, but before I did that, you know, of course I did the 4-H thing. I showed in 4-H because I could afford to go to 4-H horse shows.
Right.
Back then, 4-H horse show entries were about 50 cents. So and I could ride in six or seven classes. So, you know, for $3 or $4, that was 2 weeks' pay. I could go to a horse show, and my dad was really great. He didn't hand it to me, but he would go rent a horse trainer, and I think it cost $7 to rent a horse trainer. He'd go rent a horse trainer and haul me to the show. That was great, because I couldn't have afforded to rent the horse trainer and go to the horse show. So anyway, I did the 4-H thing, did the college thing, and in college I showed, of course, hunt seat, and we'd show, you know, in all the Western Pleasure and Western Equitation classes. They'd do trail. I'd never really had a horse I could show in trail, but I'd do stock horse and showmanship, because it was more points. And I got pretty good at showmanship to where when I was in college, I won the showmanship at Poly Royal, which was the big, you know, sort of the West Coast finals of the Intercollegiate Horse Show Association. And I could win equitation, and then I learned to ride saddle seat, so I could show more when I went to Arab shows. I was showing some Arabs for some people. And so I could do saddle seat. I did some fine harness driving.
Wow.
Western Pleasure I could, you know, do in my sleep. Of course, the stock horses. I would always take my own horse along. And then I had a really wonderful neighbor who's still one of my dearest, dearest friends. And she showed Arabs, and she had horses that were green and needed to be shown. She had both Western Pleasure and English horses, and I would show those horses for her. I also gave her daughter lessons, and in exchange for me showing her horses, she'd haul my horse to the big shows she was going to. And that, and we were like, it was looking like the Dust Bowl moving into those horse shows. We'd go, all of us in one trailer and packed into a truck, and we'd sleep in the tack room, and we had a crock pot.
Oh, that's great.
I mean, we were kind of doing it the way we could get it done, but we had a great time. And then I moved to I was working on a ranch and running a rope and arena and putting on team pinnings. Things in life changed, and I needed to pick up and go somewhere. So I had a choice of Denton, Texas, or Sandy Inez, California, going to work for cutting horse operations. And I had decided that the rein cow horse thing, there wasn't enough money in it, so maybe I needed to shift into cutters. So I went to Sandy Inez, and I just wasn't working for the right cutting horse operation. So I got a little disillusioned with that industry. And after a year, I thought, these just are not my kind of people, and the way they're doing these horses isn't right. So I stepped out of it and did other things for about 5 years. But I went back to work at a saddle shop and got interested in fox hunting, which was, there's four recognized, or at the time, there may be more than that now, but at the time there were four recognized fox hunts in California, and one of them was in Sandy Inez. And the huntsman there found out that I could ride English and that I could ride at speed, and because I had cowboyed, I knew how to get my way around on the hills safely. So I got recruited as a whipper-in for the hunt there, and when whipped for him for a year, and then when he was offered a position in Tennessee and he needed a first whip in order to tie up the job, I said, I'll go.
Oh, wow.
And it was crazy, but I picked up and moved to Tennessee and took that position, stayed for a year, finished my term with them, and then decided that East Tennessee wasn't really where I needed to be. But I had a few friends around Nashville.
Okay.
So I picked up in there and went there, and I continued with fox hunting and point-to-point racing, and had just started to get into eventing, which I loved. In the English world, that's as close to riding a cow horse as you can get.
Okay.
It's a three-event thing, like the rein cow horse snaffle bit fraternities are, and there's a lot of personal best and a lot of precision and a lot of conditioning that goes into it, and I loved that work. And so eventing was really my focus for quite a few years there, and I galloped steeplechase horses on the side because if you only have one event horse, you can't really keep fit enough galloping one. You can't put that many miles on your horse to get the fitness, the core fitness that you need. So I galloped steeplechase horses on the side. And
wow.
Middle Tennessee was a hotbed of steeplechase back 20 years ago.
Right, right.
There were probably six or seven good steeplechase trainers in the area at that time. And there's enough rainfall that the hills stay just in the right condition where you can gallop year-round. And that was a great part of education, too.
Yeah, I imagine.
So all of it. I mean, just did all of it. And I'd show my event horses in the jumpers occasionally. And sometimes I'd take them to a hunter show and show them in the hunter courses just to let them go canter around an easy course where the fences aren't complicated and let them just relax at the party and have that atmosphere. So it was all a big part of making the circle and then going away from it again for a while because I'd gotten hurt and then finally coming back.
Well, and let me ask this, and by the way, Iroquois steeplechase, I'm sure you were at many times.
Yes, many times.
And has always been a great event, a fundraiser in Middle Tennessee. But during this period of time, where was your music?
When I moved to Nashville, to Franklin, actually, The first night I was there, I went to the Bluebird to see what was going on there. And I was writing already. I had been writing for some time. I had been back and forth to Nashville a couple times. I'd had songs, you know, on hold, and I thought, oh, I've made it. I've got songs on hold. Wow, did I find out.
And
anybody that goes to Nashville, where they came from, they were the biggest fish in the bowl. And that was probably the case for me. You know, I was a member of a songwriters guild in Santa Barbara, California, and we had competitions, and I won those most of the time. I'd been back and forth in Los Angeles to the songwriters guild there and made some contacts, and things always were well received there. So I thought, oh, well, this will be a piece of cake. So the first night I was in Nashville, some friends and I went to the Bluebird, and I listened to the writers there doing their songs who didn't have a deal. And I went, oh, I have work to do. So I didn't go out and go try to do writer's nights.
All right.
I realized I have had some work to do. So I reworked some songs, and it took me about a year. And then I said, okay, it's time to go out and try. And so I went and stood in line at the Bluebird a couple of different times and finally got in. And after I did, finally got my little chance to do two songs, then someone approached me and said, hey, we've got a songwriter's night across town. We'd like you to come to ours. And then someone else approached, and then I ended up doing writer's nights. I'd do probably sometimes two or three a week, sometimes two or three a night. And
Wow. There
was a little group of us. We'd hit one that was at 7 o'clock somewhere, and then we'd run across town and hit another one at 9:30 somewhere else. And then we'd go, oh, they're doing one at midnight at such and such, and we'd all run over there. But there's no money in that.
Right. But good exposure. But,
yeah, well, exposure, yeah. You can get that in Montana in a blizzard. But, yes, it was, and it was a great education because I met a lot of people, and I wrote with some other writers and a publisher who was kind of new in town approached me to wanting to do a song-to-song deal. And after I worked with him a little bit, I realized that he was a really good word editor. So I worked with him for several years on a song-to-song deal. As a pitching publisher, he was not very good at that part. But what he did well was teach me to hone in and edit and take out unnecessary verbiage and take out whole verses I didn't need and pare things down. And he also paired me with some other writers, and that was a great education as well. So, that was going along, but you can do writer's nights till you're dead in Nashville, and it doesn't make a difference until you can get some cuts.
Right.
So, right. I went out, and he was out supposed to be pitching things, but I don't know if it ever really happened very much. But I would also do some pitching of my own, and I have a real hard time with no. It hurts my feelings. So to go out and pitch my own songs, it was really hard for me. And I realized the people that do that full-time at Song Pluggers, they just have a great way of doing those things, and they know that no doesn't mean we hate you. It means not for this project. But to a songwriter, no means we hate you, and your songs are ugly too.
Oh, my goodness.
So,
gosh.
I sort of pulled myself back from that, and I was concentrating on eventing, and I was managing a saddle shop and doing the eventing. And then I'd gotten hurt in a steeplechase galloping accident, not racing, but just galloping. You can get hurt out eventing, and you can get out hurt racing, but you're more likely to get hurt at home in a schooling accident. So
right,
that was what
right.
happened to me. I got hurt, and I got hurt actually a couple times, because once you get an injury like that, it's going to keep, things are going to keep crushing. And it wasn't until a couple years later when a really good chiropractor took a look at some x-rays and said, when did you break your neck?
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, oh, I've never broken my neck. He goes, oh, yes, you have. You've got all these hairline fractures, and they've calcified, and you've got bone spurs everywhere in your neck. That's why you have no mobility.
Oh, my.
And I went, oh, well, I know exactly when that was. That was when I, you know, couldn't lay down without crying for about 4 months. He goes, yeah, that would be the time.
Oh, God.
So I was working retail. I decided, all right, that's it. I am not working one more Christmas in retail. That's it. I've got to figure out a different way. And just about that time, I had done my first album. It was a long shot, but we had pitched it to one label that was about to fold, not knowing it was about to fold, and then pitched it to another a more folk-oriented label that was also at that time carrying Riders in the Sky. And my friend Ranger Doug from Riders in the Sky had suggested, you know, this might be a good fit for you, but mm-hmm. they couldn't take me unless I was touring X amount of dates a year, and I wasn't. I was managing a tack shop. Mm-hmm. So nobody really knew what to do with that album. I ended up releasing it on my own, and it sort of sat around, and nobody knew what to do with it for about 4 years. And then a pirated copy found its way into the hands of Gary Brown, who was a festival director in California. He lived in Central California, not far from my mom, and he was running the Monterey Cowboy Poetry and Music Festival. He listened to it. He told me about 4 times in a row. He played it for Dave Stamey and said, am I hearing what I think I'm hearing? And Dave said, I don't know who that is, but you better get her at Monterey next year. And he called me and he said, if you can do this live, I have a spot for you on the Monterey Festival for next year. And I said, I can do it live.
Wow.
And he said, we'll bring you out. Well, that was my first Western festival. They didn't know whether I was really Western or not because I was from Nashville, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
So they thought, and I didn't, I said, oh, no, I've got, you know, ranch background. But I didn't talk about it very much because it was my past, and I just, I don't need to talk about that. You know, this is what I do. And I went out, and they went, oh, she is Western. Like, well, yeah, I'm from California. You know, that's Western.
I started to say that's like, you know, what goes around comes around, from California to Nashville and back to California.
Yeah. So anyway, that sort of started it. And because Gary took a chance and put me in, other people thought, well, if Gary took a chance and put you in, we'll take a chance and put you in too. And so I got several sight unseen, you know, bookings because Gary was brave enough to put me in, and they go, well, if Gary put you in, you know, we guess we should too, and that sort of started the ball rolling. And after a couple years, I kept working at the tack shop, and I go out part time and do music. I'd maybe go out for a weekend, and then I got to where I go out for a week, and then I go out for 2 weeks, and you know, and then at one point I said, all right. It's just time to make a decision, and I just made a decision. If I could get this many bookings ahead, then I feel like I can make a break. So I did, and it was like stepping off a cliff.
Wow. Well,
but,
I'll tell you.
I figured I could always go back and work retail if I needed to. I always could have my job back in Santa Ynez. At the tack shop there. I mean, I had a lot of different things I could do, and I had other tack shops wanting me to come there. So I thought, I've got something to go back to if I need to. But once I stepped out of it, I thought, I don't need to go back. I'm good.
Well, and you know what? We're glad that you did. And I want to take just a break right now, and let's listen to Listen. And you want to tell us about this song?
I do. When I was a young and kind of struggling cowhorse trainer, Greg Ward was my hero. He lived just about 10 miles from where I grew up. And Greg Ward he won the National Reined Cowhorse Association. It's now the National Reined Cowhorse Association. It used to be the California Reined Cowhorse Association. Snafflebit Futurity. He won it 4 times in his lifetime. That's like winning the Olympics.
Wow.
A gold medal in the Olympics 4 times. He was such a horseman, and he would tell us, if you just shut up and listen to what your horse is trying to tell you, he'll tell you what he needs, but you gotta just pay attention here. So that was the basis of listen. And, you know, if we do stop and listen to what they're trying to tell us and start trying to see what they're seeing instead of just looking through their ears and going, why are you afraid of that? Are you stupid? Like, well, they have a reason. They have good reason. And we got to stop and hear what they're trying to tell us. So that's where listen came from.
All right. Well, we're going to stop talking for just a minute and let everybody enjoy this great song, Listen, by Junie Fisher.
Love when you try.
Well, you're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio, and we're talking with Junie Fisher. And Junie, that is the title song from your album, Listen to the Horse. And just a great album. And I've been really privileged to be able to go through and listen to the different songs that are on there. So we want to encourage people to pick that up. And where can they get the album or the single?
They can go on my website. It's www.junifisher.com. It's JUNIFISHER.com. And they can order the album, or there's also options to go on CD Baby and order the singles, or they can get them on Amazon, and they can get them on iTunes.
All right. Well, I encourage people to do that. It's absolutely a great album, and so
Thank
many
you.
Songs that I wish we had more time to play everything that was on there today. But let's talk a little bit about the Western music genre, and mm-hmm. you and I talked a little bit the other day about the difference between Western music and cowboy music and
yeah.
the country music, and you obviously going from Nashville to the Monterey Festival that you ran made a decision to go with the Western music. And what's the difference for our listeners that may not be aware?
Well, to me now, from my viewpoint behind my guitar, Western music is the folk music of the American West. Now, that's not necessarily everybody's description, and there are people that will say, well, Western music is cowboy music. And I say, yes, cowboy music is Western music.
But okay.
Western music is not necessarily just cowboy music. It also encompasses the folk music of the American West, and it encompasses music that's inspired by Celtic origins, English origins, Welsh, Irish and Scottish being Celtic, and Welsh is Celtic as well. There's Spanish origins, and anybody who made their way west took their native music with them, and they adapted it to what was going on around them. So those were the basis of the traditional, what we consider, cowboy songs. There were so many more factors of the West than just the whole cattle drive cowboy movement. There were settlers, and there were immigrants who made their way out onto the plains for the free land, and they lived in holes in the ground practically, you know, in cut banks with and added boards and roofs as they could, and all kinds of people that made. There were Chinese that were brought over by thousands in boatloads to work in the mines and then on railroad jobs.
Right.
So many people made up the West, and those are the stories that, for some writers, get told through Western music. Some people say, no, what we do is cowboy music. Well, that's all great. And then there's the contemporary Western music, which is about the contemporary issues of the West, of ranching and farming, and there's some great writers of that that I think are doing a tremendous job. A guy named Darren Little up in Wyoming is doing a great job with that. Dave Stamey is one of the great contemporary writers, and he also writes from a historical slant. So I think it encompasses a lot of things, and Western swing is also encompassed in Western music.
Right.
But that's where the lines get a little muddy, because Western swing is also, you know, dance music, and sometimes it's about drinking and whiskey and and dancing, and so not necessarily the cowboy code or about a Western lifestyle. So to me, Western music is the music of the American West, and that encompasses a lot of ground. Cowboy music is about cowboys specifically.
Okay. Well, and I like your definition of Western music being the folk music of the West. I think that's a great definition for that. Tell me about the Western Music Association, and I know they have an annual convention every year and some big things that are coming up pretty soon there. And, you know, I mentioned earlier you have been the Entertainer of the Year with the Western Music Association, and Female Performer and Song of the Year, and you're nominated in five for 5 different awards this time. Mm-hmm. But tell us a little bit about the Western Music Association and what that involves.
Well, the Western Music Association is an organization, I'm writing from the website just so that I get the verbiage correct. And let me say that this is something that we didn't take lightly when we rework the wording so that people understand. The Western Music Association is an organization that encourages and supports the preservation, performance, and composition of historic, traditional, and contemporary music and poetry of the West. That just, I think, puts it perfectly.
Yeah.
And the organization was formed 25 years ago, and it was formed by a group of people that loved cowboy music and music of the West, and they got together and said, hey, we need to have an organization, and they got things rolling, and the organization has gone through a lot of changes and a lot of restructuring over the years, but at present, I'm going to say it's stronger than it's ever been. We have people that are coming from all walks of life, introducing Western music to their places. We have chapters in the East. We have state chapters all over the United States. We have people in Europe that are DJs that are playing our music and promoting Western music, and it has just grown by leaps and bounds. I'm trying to think how long ago I first went. Well, this might be my 10th year.
Okay.
10th or 11th year at the Western Music Association convention, and it has just grown by leaps and bounds. And a lot of that is due to some very diligent work by the board of directors and the executive directors to keep things solvent and make an event once a year where people can come together and do workshops and seminars. We have an awards show. We have ticketed shows where people can come and see a lot of entertainment. And we have the best part of it is staying up all night and jamming. And if you go to bed before 2 o'clock, you're just the biggest sissy in the world.
I start to say that would be wimping out on that. So
that's wimping
now,
out, yeah.
It's wimping out. So now when is this and where is it located?
It is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and it'll start on November 20th. We'll start out with a Herb Jeffries 100th birthday celebration. Herb was the bronze buckaroo, and he was also the last surviving member of the Duke Ellington band, but just really living. He was the living legend, and the Albuquerque jazz community is going to be there with us to join in, and we're going to have his 100th birthday party. And then on Thursday, we start out with some workshops. We have a coffee with the DJs workshop, how to get airplay and learn more about what Western DJs are looking for. We've got a gal, Judy James, who is a wonderful DJ from Texas and a singer herself, and she's going to be talking about how to do educational workshops at schools, and if you want to do performances at schools, here's what you need to know to do that. And then there's another one, Working With Your Sound Man, by our own Sid Masters, who is a great performer in New Mexico and wrote the New Mexico official state song.
Oh, great.
And he'll be doing that. And we've got a yodeling workshop with Judy Coder, great, wonderful, wonderful melodic yodeler she is. And then we'll be doing a forum, myself and a couple other gals, on social media, digital marketing. We've got songwriting sessions. We have a crisis fund dinner, and that's we have a wonderful group that has organized a crisis fund. So if we find out that one of our own or that someone within the music community has had a catastrophic event, we can step in and say, We can help with that. So,
oh, that's great.
There's youth chapter workshops, poetry workshops. There's a mercantile, just all kinds of great things going on.
Well, that sounds like an event that people need to put on their calendar, and that's November the 20th is when
it
that
starts
in Albuquerque.
Starts on the 20th, and it goes in Albuquerque, and it goes through Sunday the 24th. ends up with the Cowboy Church.
All right, great. Well, Junie, you have been so much fun to talk to. We're going to have to do another show.
Yes.
And,
I just looked at the time. My gosh, I'm so sorry, Bobby Joe.
Well, we're going to be talking with Bobby Joe Lieberman in just a little bit, but want people to check the now, what's the website for the Western Music Association?
It's www.westernmusic.org.
Okay. www.westernmusic.org, and you can check that out for more information on their event in Albuquerque starting on the 20th. And then I really would encourage people to visit your website, junifisher.com, and check your tour dates, because I think people really need to come out and visit and see where you're performing, listen
to
your music.
Yes, I'd love
to
see you.
Yeah, so listen, you've been great. Love talking to you. And,
Thank you, Gary.
And let's do this again. And we're going to close out with your song, Fly, and that is from your new album, Listen to the Horse. And we wish you the best of luck with all of these awards and nominations that you've been receiving, and we certainly can understand why. So, Junie, thanks so much. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Gary. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we'll be back.
Life stories. Sometimes they were what got me through, but hardship and heartache got to me, made me doubt all that I knew. Then I spent my life dragging a shadow, wasted youth chasing a light. Finally came back to what I needed most, and everything when I ride. So we dance to the heartbeat of hoofbeats in a harmony without a sound, with the reins in my hands there is freedom to fly. You allow me to sit on your back. When I let go and let you be a horse, you give me the courage I lack. It's a partnership old as the ages, ever changing who teaches who. There have been some horsemen who've helped me, teacher I've learned from is you. We dance to the heartbeat of hoofbeats in a harmony without a sound, with the reins in my hands there is freedom to fly. Without speaking, you comfort my soul and quiet the storm in my mind. Who needs the rest of the world when I'm riding, I let it go by. While we dance to the heartbeat of hoofbeats, fly
listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio, and that was Junie Fisher's song Fly. And we're very happy to have joining us now for this second segment of our program, Bobby Joe Lieberman, who is the managing editor of Trailblazer Magazine, a 40-plus year career in the equine journalism world. And so, Bobby Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gary. It's a delight to be here, and I just love listening to Junie.
Well, I appreciate you holding on. We hope that it wasn't too inconvenient for you to stay with us there, but enjoyed talking with her.
I loved her lyrics. If you would just listen, that really says it all right there.
Well, I think so, and I know that is an approach that you take to your horsemanship, and we're going to talk more about that. But again, for our listeners, they like to know a little bit about people's horse background, and I know from a little research that I did that your first horse was a horse named Bright Angel.
Yes, she was lived in my imagination, but I can still remember galloping with her over the fields of our suburban Chicago neighborhood, which was still pretty rural in those days. And yep, she was my first.
Well, I found that very interesting that your first horse was Bright Angel, and that was an imaginary horse. And I think I also read that you had created an imaginary breeding farm as well.
I did, and the mares all did embryo transfer. It was sort of the flip side of what we're doing now, but the mare was what was important. And as I would later learn from Dr. Bill Munson, a famous breeder of Arabians, it's all about the mares.
Well, that's true, and sometimes we forget that. Sometimes we forget. Now, how old were you when you created this imaginary breeding farm and had Bright Angel?
I have no idea. Maybe 8, 10, 8.
Oh, gosh.
Pretty young. But I also used to recruit all my little grammar school friends into having races, horse races.
Oh, that's neat.
We all had to, so that was fun too, because I didn't have a real horse till I was 13.
Well, tell us about your first horse and how that came about, and a little bit about your horse background.
Okay, well, I begged and begged, of course, for a horse from the time I could walk, and it was always, well, someday we'll see, and then the watershed moment came. We moved from Chicago to Minnesota in 1961, and I said, I'm not going unless I get a horse, and it worked.
Shortly
after we arrived in the Minneapolis area, I purchased a little bay gelding named Little Stormy, who was really a perfect first horse, and we won High Point trophies and galloped all over the countryside and had a lot of fun.
Well, that's neat.
My second horse was an Arabian Quarter Cross named Flip, and we did a lot of Gymkhana, barrels, poles, and all that. And I loved him until I went away to college and had to rehome him at that point. But by my senior year of being horseless, I'd had enough of that. So I purchased a weanling Arabian colt, of all things.
Wow.
That was Kabur. That was Kabur, and he's the one who sort of got me started on trail and endurance after several years of show ring, which was a lot of fun. We did stock horse and trail obstacles and Western pleasure. But one day, we headed out the arena gate, went up our first hill, and never looked back. It was just a wonderful transition into a whole new world.
Well, have you been involved in endurance since that time? I mean, has that been an ongoing thing for you?
Well, I when in, let's see, from Red Wing, Minnesota, where I was news editor of a local paper, I had always dreamed of writing about horses to combine my two passions.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1977, I noticed a small classified ad in Editor and Publisher magazine, which was the way in those days that all journalists found new jobs. It was
okay.
A new magazine starting in Gaithersburg, Maryland, called Equus,
1977.
Uh-huh. Ami Shinitsky had an epiphany driving home from the Washington International Horse Show. He realized that no magazine was about the horse. It was
wow.
about showing and people and competition, but not the horse, his physiology, his behavior. And I said, this is for me. So I sat down at a typewriter, which is what we had in those pre-computer days, and I wrote an impassioned letter, and I got a call from Ami. And I was just stunned. And he said, I'm very interested in your background. He was
wow.
an Israeli former philosophy professor turned equine dentist and polo player. So he was
wow.
very eclectic. And he had a vision, and so they flew me out to Maryland, and I was hired as assistant managing editor. So that began a wonderful journalism journey in, you know, my dream job of a lifetime. And shortly after I arrived at my job, I met Matthew McKay Smith, DVM, who was the medical editor of Equus. It was the first magazine to ever have a medical editor.
Okay.
And Matthew was already in the AERC Endurance Riding Hall of Fame. He and his wife, Winky, were very active 100-mile competitors on the Old Dominion ride, which was sort of the Tevis Cup of the East Coast.
Right.
And arguably tougher than Tevis, with
really?
Much more climbing, plus all the humidity that the riders had to contend with. So I immediately just became immersed in an education of endurance. I crewed for Matthew and Winky just a month later on my first Old Dominion. Then I went home, got on my little Arab mare, and said, I'm going to start conditioning for the Old Dominion, but promptly was dumped in the ditch.
Oh, no.
Suffered a compression fracture of L1, but that didn't stop me. The next year, I completed the 50-mile Old Dominion on a friend's horse. And the following year, I rode Rush Creek Ingrid. And Rush Creek is synonymous with great endurance horses and bloodlines.
Okay.
And I was fortunate enough to have a Rush Creek mare named Ingrid, who was just a brilliant mare. And we finished fifth on our first Old Dominion and third in the Vermont 100 the same year.
Wow.
So that was wonderful, but you know what? When your first horse is a great horse, you think, oh, this is easy. Try to duplicate that with your next horse. She stood alone as a really wonderful mare. So,
wow.
But my journey continued, and I've had wonderful, not that many over the 30-plus years, but a wonderful Arabian named Fine Print, a Polish Arabian, Pearl, who sadly succumbed to a rattlesnake bite just as her career was beginning, and Anna Kate, who's a Bay Morgan mare, who's just a phenomenal competitor and can just go forever. She has over 2,000 endurance miles and has only been lightly campaigned. My
wow.
husband is riding her now, and they're just doing wonderfully together. So somewhere in the middle of all this, I was introduced to a black Tennessee Walker mare named Gypsy. And when one of my other horses, when Pearl had passed away to the rattlesnake, my friend said, here, I'm gonna give you Gypsy. You can ride her. She is the smoothest, sanest, smartest mare I ever knew. She took care of the rider. Even when she was doing a little extracurricular activity, she would make sure you stayed in the middle. I never came off Gypsy. We did 1,550 endurance miles together.
Wow.
Smooth, all of them smooth.
Well, and you know I'm a walking horse person, so I love to hear stories about walking horses excelling in different disciplines. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Oh yeah.
Now during all of this time that we've just talked about, were you still with Equus during that period?
I hadn't. Although I was still freelancing for them for quite a few years.
Uh-huh.
I had transitioned from Equus in the early 90s to a spin-off publication that Ami started called Modern Horse Breeding. And as the name implies, it was a journal for breeders, veterinarians, and farm managers. And it was a very narrow niche, but it was extremely well-regarded, and it even won the General Excellence Award from the American Horse Publications in 89, beating Equus. And
wow.
I guess that was not politically correct. Soon after, I was offered the magazine. It said, I don't think we want to publish such a small magazine, so here, you take it, and you publish it, and you have a great time. And I did, and I published it on my own, in my home, for I'm not even sure how long, but ultimately I had a call from the publisher of The Blood Horse, and they said, we like this little magazine and we'd like to buy it. And so those were the days when direct mail was really the only way to grow a magazine, and very, very expensive to do. We didn't have the internet to help us then in any big way. So I was happy to let go of my baby, and it went on, and it morphed into The Horse, which is still a magazine, a going magazine. So that was a good interlude, but I was ready for something new at that point, brand new. So I, again, reading the Washington Post classified ads, I saw an ad for managing editor of a newsletter to be written by Dr. Christiane Northrup, who was a pioneering women's health physician. And I applied for the job, got the job, and had a wonderful relationship with Phillips Publishing, now Healthy Directions is their name now, and learned a lot about marketing and advocacy journalism and passion and leadership. So that was a great, great thing. And then I freelanced. I did freelance for many, many different publications, including Equus. And then one day I had a call from Susanna Gibson, who has published Trailblazer magazine. This will be the 36th year of consecutive publishing. I know. I started reflecting on that before we spoke, and I began to cry because she's a very private person, and many people don't know the underlying passion and dedication she brings to this magazine and the excellence that she brings, the creativity, the design. The magazine is famous for its covers. But even more, the information is very solid. Both Susanna was an endurance rider as well and very successful, and she put on something called the Race of Champions, which was the elite 100-mile race that you had to finish 500-mile rides just to qualify.
Oh, wow.
So she's a visionary, and we've known each other for all this time, and she said, I want you to come and be my managing editor. So I was living in southern Arizona at the time. She was living in Prescott. And so she drove down, and, you know, we met again and decided we would move forward. And so I have been in this wonderful position now for going on 5 years.
Wow. Well, and the nice thing is that you have been able to combine your passion for horses and journalism throughout all this time. And
it is, you know, really a gift. It's not like work.
Yeah, it's
a joy. It's a total joy.
Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah. You know, we were just talking with Junie before, and she was more involved with the horses, and then later into the music, and now she's involved in both. And what a treat that it is to be able to combine your passions and have a career out of that. So that's just terrific.
And work from the ranch.
Oh yeah, that's just a plus. That is absolutely a plus.
We don't have no need to go into an office with today's technology.
Well, and I can appreciate that because I'm sitting here looking out at my horses from my studio. And so that's a lot of fun to be able to do that. I want to play take a quick break and play a song that talks about the love of horses. And when we come back, I want to talk more about your involvement with the endurance racing. And I know you have a holistic approach to horsemanship that we want to talk about. And so this is The Love of Horses. You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio, and we'll be right back to talk again with Bobby Joe Lieberman.
I love them from the start. They're in my veins, run in my blood. And if I live to be 100, I'll never get enough. They fill our days, they grace our lives. Our hearts beat the same. Our links on the same chain, the kindred spirits everywhere. This love of horses that we share. Some pinto, some sorrow, the pony, the pasos, palominos, they're in my dreams, they keep me smiling, yeah, when I go on to the next life, I know I'll be riding. Fill our days, they grace our lives. Our hearts beat the same. Those of us who feel this way are linked on the same chain. The kindred spirit everywhere. This love of horses that we share. Are
Equestrian Legacy Radio, and we're talking with Bobby Joe Lieberman. That was Marianne Kennedy's This Love of Horses, and I think that really applies to what we're talking about. And so, Bobby Joe, we were talking just briefly during that break about your holistic approach to horsemanship. And how did that evolve for you?
Well, if you want to go back to the very, very beginning, way back when I lived in Maryland working for Equus, I had a cat who developed hypothyroidism. And the vet wanted to put him on a heavy drug, which would create a lot of side effects. So I did a consult with a homeopathic veterinarian, and the prescription was for sodium iodide. I have no idea if this is still homeopathically a solution, but he got better, and he lived on for many more years. So that triggered my interest in holistic care. I also was a friend of, back in the Virginia, Maryland area, Dr. Joyce Harmon, who is a pioneering equine holistic veterinarian. And I had another cat with terrible allergies, a long-haired cat. Every year her tail would go bare, and she was just a mess. So Joyce said to me, no more vaccinations, which at the time was a kind of a, you know, a stunning thing to say, this vaccination issue, which is controversial. There's a lot more light being shed upon the risks and limitations of vaccinations for our animals. Over-vaccination is a real, real issue. So my cat went on to be healthy and hearty for 18 years, and that was another turning point. But when I worked for Phillips Publishing, now Healthy Directions, I had a chance to work with another pioneering small animal veterinarian named Dr. Bob Goldstein. He and his brother Marty were both pioneers and authors, and we did a newsletter called Love of Animals, and every month we explored various angles of holistic medicine. I helped them publish their book, and I just learned a lot during those years working for those newsletters, working with those experts who freely shared their knowledge and expertise. And again, this is before a lot of this information was so readily available online.
Right.
And, you know, it was all a whole new world for everyone to learn and embrace. So today, it is even more imperative that we pay attention with the onset of genetically modified foods. I spoke with Dr. Harmon just a few weeks ago, and boy, the whole beet pulp issue has really come into a head. I've been hearing mumblings and murmurings and whispers that beet pulp isn't that great, folks, and I ignored it. It was like, what? Beet pulp, you know, I just couldn't believe it. But after speaking with Joyce, the thing is, beet pulp was approved for genetically modified, which means, does everybody know what that means? I hope. But they're able to produce Roundup Ready. Roundup is the culprit, the Monsanto product that is already, has a, its seeds already with a built-in pesticide. They go into the ground and into the beets. So it's worse with beet pulp than like with soy and corn, which is also nearly 100% GMO in our country.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets into the beet pulp, and the incredible popularity of beet pulp has just intensified the whole issue because it's, have you noticed, it's becoming dustier. And it's just not a good feed anymore. So, and it's contained in most all complete feeds that you buy.
Huh.
And I know this may be heresy for many to hear, but I have taken my horses, my 10 horses, completely off beet pulp and completely off complete feeds. And now they're getting Timothy pellets, alfalfa pellets, and a line of holistic products. I don't know if it's okay to mention the name.
Well, you can.
It's called ABC Products. They're made in Illinois, and I think we basically over-supplement our horses. Horses
yeah.
that have access to pasture, they know how to pick out what they need from the grasses. And we're in Texas, so we're really fortunate, although it's boom and bust with the drought. We've had a lot of rain in the last 3 weeks, so right now we have good native grasses, and the horses are out there. They didn't come up for 3 days. Of course, I was worried to death. They're
mm-hmm.
back now. But
right.
They know how to, they have nutritional wisdom, and they can pick and choose among the plants and the time of day when different nutrients are more available. So keeping horses as part of that holistic viewpoint, to bring it back, it's really important that horses have ideally room to run, and I know for many this is just not possible.
Right.
But we owe our horses the chance to lead an interesting life, not just stick them in a pen and go out on weekends.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I learned just this past week, I was at a trick training camp in Dripping Springs, Texas, put on by Imagine a Horse, Suzanne De Laurentiis and her husband, Alan Pogue, who are world-class trick trainers. But it's not just tricks. It's not tricks like, oh, look at the cute horsey, you know, counting to 10. Those aren't tricks. This is a whole different approach to tricks in which the intelligence of the horse is honored, in which the horse has a say in what he does. The culmination of this wonderful 4 days of learning, Alan did a demonstration in the round pen with between 3 and 5 horses at liberty, doing everything from mounting pedestals, mounting rotating pedestals, sitting on beanbags, rearing, imagine a horse lunging, imagine at liberty with no line. Imagine
right.
two horses going in one direction, one horse going the opposite, and they thread the needle. The one horse goes between the other two, all at liberty, all on
wow.
voice cue. So we were all astounded, and, you know, this was just the most beautiful thing. And then Alan said, okay, now you're going to do it. to the group, like, oh, really? Well, everybody went in there, and the horses made sure that the people looked good. If they weren't quite sure what the request was, they would do something. And it was the most fun and funny and beautiful example of what happens when you give horses the chance to express themselves and to think.
Uh-huh.
And it just moves you so much to realize this, to see how we dampen horses' potential so much when we're this whole thing about repetition. That just dulls a horse. Yes, some repetition is needed for muscle memory and so forth, but
right.
Sue and Alan say no more than 3. Forget about this 100,000 times, you know, that you
right.
often hear that horses need to repeat. That's just training a horse by rote. He's not thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just a wonderful experience in truly learning to be with horses in a new way. It was really fun.
Well, I think more and more people today are looking for a partnership with their horse, and connecting and communicating with their animals. And to me, one of the biggest stress relievers that I have is just to go out and spend some time with my horses and be part of their herd, or let them be part of my herd. Actually, I think they become part of my herd, but.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, that's so true. And we do a feature in Trailblazer called the Facebook Post. We have a Facebook page with over 20,000 fans and growing. And every month we pose a question on Facebook. And readers respond, and we publish as many of them as we can fit and then do a drawing or choose the winner.
Right.
And the one we just did was, how do you spoil your horse? And I actually picked the winner, and the one I picked was a gal who just goes out in a chair and sits with her horse and reads to him. And just
wow.
Reads to him. And
wow.
This was a former fourth-level dressage horse who only knew, you know, go in the ring and perform. He had no
right.
relationship with anyone. And when she stops reading, he pushes her arm. And that just touched me. That just touched
yeah.
me. But there were so many beautiful responses. And you know, we cover hoof care. And I'm a huge advocate of barefoot care. And you know, we trim all our own horses. And it's really an eye-opener, because barefoot is really about lifestyle. It's not just the feet. It's
uh-huh.
nutrition. It's nutrition and turnout and terrain and so many things play into, because the hoof reflects the overall health of the horse.
Right.
And, you know, it's just a wonderful area for exploration and learning for every horse owner can have the tools to take back the health of their horse's feet.
Yeah, and you know, when you were talking about when you were talking earlier about the type of feed and the type of turnout and those types of things for our horses, you know, I've had people that have talked to me about, well, my horse has had this, or we've had colic, we've had foot problems, we've had different things
yeah.
that have gone on, and I've raced horses for over 50 years.
Wow.
For the most
wow.
part, my horses have always stayed out on pasture. And
great.
Unless I just want to give them a treat,
yeah.
they don't get grain.
Good.
Now during the winter they do. You know, it's a little
yeah.
important
good.
To supplement during the cold weather that we have. But otherwise they don't, and I don't have any problems
yeah.
with my horses.
Well, good. There you go.
Yeah. So I
yeah.
think it
live
really
live a natural life.
They yeah they stay outside in the weather, and you know, they do have some natural shelter that they use and make sure that that's
yeah.
there. But sometimes I guess we just over
yeah.
do things because we love, you know, we love our horses, we think we're doing something good, and maybe it's not necessarily the best thing on there. So
you're right.
Yeah. So how did you get involved with the walking horses? Gypsy was your first one, and you've got several now. Let's talk about these walking horses and endurance for just a minute.
Okay.
We have a mutual
well,
friend, Keith Keebler, that was on, and I know Keith is very active in endurance with his gated horses.
Yes, yes. Well, after Gypsy, my mission was to find another horse like her. So... I'm not 100% sure I've achieved it, but I like all the walkers I have, and each has a special gift. The horse I bought from Keith, Jazz, Dancer Southern Princess, is an incredible athlete. She looks like she's built like a thoroughbred, and she's in a good way. She's really athletic, and she has a resting heart rate of 24, which is truly freakish. And so we've had a few issues, but we're working through them, and we've done some endurance rides, and we're looking forward to doing more this fall. We've got a 5-year-old mare named Illusion, Lux Champagne Illusion, that
uh-huh.
we brought down here as a 2-year-old from Oregon with her mother La Nina, who was then in foal to shot a horse named Shotgun. And we were raising the baby, who is a stunning Palomino heartbreaker filly. And, in fact, we took her up to Sue's when my friend and I went up for the trip training camp, and we're leaving there for charm school for 2 weeks so she can learn a few basics. And she's
okay.
already been introduced to the pedestal, and she'll pick up objects. Two other of the big tricks, not to digress, are picking up objects. And believe it or not, horses can be trained to retrieve objects.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Truly amazing. But so we've got La Nina and Athena, her baby, Illusion, who is a close to 16-hand, gorgeous black walking mare. And we sort of semi-rescued. He's an unregistered but obviously very walker, very classic black walker.
Uh-huh.
With an unbelievable gait. I mean, he just gaits standing still. He's so gated. And he's a little nervous. I think he had some past trauma in his life. So we're just taking it really slow with him. So he learns that he's safe with us. And he's doing real good. He's getting better with every ride. And we're detoxing him, because that's another huge component of the holistic angle, is all these vaccinations. You do put, the body pays a price.
Mm-hmm.
Most vaccines, except for maybe a handful, they use mercury as an adjuvant. And every time you vaccinate your horse, you're putting mercury into the system. And as we know, mercury is the most toxic metal of all.
Right.
So a lot of these horses who have unexplained behavior issues, they probably need detox. And this can be done with herbs, and you can do hair analysis to find out exactly where the, you know, if he's got lead, if he's got mercury, whatever he's got, you can see where he stands. And then you can supplement accordingly with various trace minerals and chelation minerals and things like that to bring him back into balance. We're big fans of organic herbs that you can purchase in bulk and can really help behavioral issues like moody mares and horses that need general detox. We've really had some good results using various herbs.
Well, so, that's great. And you have articles in Trailblazer that would address some of those things?
Yes, actually we do. Yeah. I actually wrote a story about moody mares. It's been a couple of years. If anybody wants it, I'd be glad to send them a PDF of it. We offer digital subscriptions now as well as print. And actually the website, the Trailblazer website is trailblazermagazine.us, a little bit of a different tagline.
Okay.
US.com. And it's really fun, and you can see what we do.
Well, what is coming up in Trailblazer? How do you select your covers for those, by the way?
Well,
and your cover
Susanna has a knack for finding these brilliant covers, and they come from all over the world. There are some European and Russian photographers who are incredibly artistic.
Uh-huh.
And we always say that the next issue, the current issue is our best, but the next one will be even better. And I think that's true. We're always surprising ourselves. But, well, this month we have an endurance rider galloping through the forest in southern Texas, just looking phenomenal. And the month before, we had this is a European horse. He was coming through the water. It's a real close-up of a horse coming through water. All you can see is the arms and the hat of the rider.
Oh, wow.
But there are two spouts of water coming out of the horse's nose.
Oh, gosh.
He looks like a sea monster.
We'll have to watch for that one. I wanted to ask you mentioned European. Is Trailblazer available in print form overseas?
Sad to say it isn't, but I believe we can do digital overseas.
Okay. All right. Well, I wanted to ask that question because we have a lot of listeners that are out of the country, and so we want them to be able to enjoy Trailblazer magazine. And
I don't see why they do digital.
Yeah, so they can go to the website trailblazermagazine.us
Yes.
And subscribe that way?
Yes.
Okay. All right. All right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this has been fascinating. I just I envy your lifestyle. To be able to enjoy your horses and to be able to write about what you love and to have been able to enjoy that career. And you meet a lot of interesting folks, I'm sure.
Oh, tremendously. Yeah.
So,
I didn't mention that I've been a friend and colleague and co-author with Linda Tellington Jones since the early 80s as well. And started with a three-part series in Equus called The Touch That Teaches when she was kind of new in the U.S. So that's been a great journey, and we spent 7 years writing her flagship book called The Ultimate Guide. Let me see if I can remember it. The Ultimate Guide to Horse Training and Behavior.
Okay.
An enlightened approach for the 21st century.
Okay, so you co-wrote that one with Linda Tellington Jones, and then you have another one that you wrote with Peggy Cummings?
Yes, Peggy Cummings, who is another wonderful, brilliant woman who has a groundwork and a written component, as Linda does as well. But her book is her book? It's called Connect with Your Horse from the Ground Up. And her work is extremely transformative. And it's not like just another new approach, but it's actually based on physics, you know, principles of equal and opposite. And will explode many, many common myths of riding. Heels down, chin up. Because we really don't want to be rigid in the saddle.
Right.
We don't want to be a silhouette. We want our body to oscillate. Our torso must oscillate 1 degree in front of and back of an imaginary plumb line. In other words, we need to be a little bit giving, like a buoy on the water.
Right.
And we must be in what Peggy calls neutral pelvis. When you're in neutral pelvis, then you cannot be thrown off balance, and you will probably not come off your horse because you are able to respond if your horse should spook or do something unexpected.
Well, that's a book everybody needs to read then. Let me ask you, these two books, where are they available?
They are available from Trafalgar Square Books. Trafalgar, T-R-A-F-A-L-G-A-R, Trafalgar Square. They're in Vermont.
Okay.
And they are probably the major publisher of horse books of all types. And you can also go to horseandriderbooks.com.
I just
happened to spot their new catalog, horseandriderbooks.com.
All right.
And you can see their entire list.
And did I read somewhere that you and your husband are working on a book?
Yes, actually, well, we've been working on it since we met. it's a book about diet. It's called The Sassy Salad Secret, and it's an easy way to incorporate whole, living, green, delicious foods into your diet with nuts and seeds and sun-dried tomatoes and avocados and leafy greens and red peppers and olive oil and apple cider vinegar and, oh, my gosh.
I'm getting hungry.
It's basically what we eat.
Right.
And the funny part is I was diagnosed with diabetes in 2009, and that was my big wake-up call for health.
Uh-huh.
And so I went on this. I created this salad because I didn't have the time to prepare elaborate food, and so it's quick and easy. The healthier you get, the less you need to eat, and we're sort of down to one meal a day, one salad a day, but with a little hummus and cheese and a few snacks. We're not rigid raw foodies, and I just found out yesterday that raw food is dead, rest in peace. In terms of you must eat nothing but raw, that's over. But to incorporate as much, make part of your diet raw, and that's very beneficial for health.
Yeah.
And organic. I cannot stress the importance of organic enough. It really doesn't cost that much more.
Right.
And
well,
the more
you know,
we support it, the better.
Yeah. Well, it's important for people to have healthy horses and for humans to be healthy so they can continue to enjoy life and enjoy their horses.
That's true.
And, you know, a few of us are getting older. And so in order to continue to enjoy what we love, we've got to try to keep our bodies healthy and enjoy these things. My dad was riding horses into his 80s, and I'd love to be able to do that. And I know we have some people that are in their 90s that are still riding horses. So, you know, what a privilege to be able to enjoy something we love for a long time. It really is.
Yeah, I love what you said about horses and people. We both have a responsibility to keep ourselves healthy in a toxic world.
And it becomes more difficult to do that, I think, without being careful.
Yes.
And you have to be knowledgeable today about the things that you're putting inside your body and your livestock, too.
Right.
So
you have been
a ton of fun to talk with.
Aww.
And we probably could do another hour. But I'm about to run out of time, and I'd love to have you come back on the show again another time and visit with us.
Oh, that's very sweet.
Yeah.
Sure, I'd love to. Thank you.
Well, that'd be great. Well, you have been great, and again, I appreciate you holding at the beginning of this as long as you did, and it's just been a pleasure to talk with you, and I'm sure a pleasure for our audience to be listening today. Give us one more time your website address for Trailblazer Magazine.
Okay. It's www.trailblazermagazine.us.
Okay. And we want people to check that out. And then also your Facebook page is Trailblazer Magazine?
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes,
okay.
It is.
And so for folks that are on Facebook, be sure and check out Trailblazer and like their page. And
absolutely.
Yeah, we want a lot of like
every week.
All right.
Lots of prizes.
And, we want to invite people to visit our Facebook page, Equestrian Legacy Radio. And I told somebody last week, Michael Martin Murphy was on the show, and his Facebook page, he said, I need a lot of likes. He said, I like to be liked.
All right.
So
well, let's
like all these pages. Well, listen, thanks so much. I appreciate very much, Bobby Joe, you joining us today, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Well, thank you, Gary, and thank you for the wonderful job you're doing.
Well, thanks so much.
Really
appreciate
is.
It. All right, talk to you soon.
Talk soon. Okay,
all right,
take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Well, we've had a great show today. I have thoroughly enjoyed our guest. We had Junie Fisher on, who was in the first part of the program, and Bobby Joe Lieberman. And so we hope you found this show enjoyable. We invite you to join us next week on Equestrian Legacy Radio. We are live at noon Central Standard Time, and all of our programs are available in a podcast for you to go back and enjoy and share with your friends. Next week we have a great show. We'll be talking about horse health. We'll also be listening to a new young artist that I think you'll find exciting. And so join us next week on Equestrian Legacy Radio at noon Central Standard Time. And remember, if you climb in the saddle, get ready for the ride. We're going to close the show today with a song by Junie Fisher called Nighthawk. Thanks for listening.
As they raced through his veins with a fire of their own.
He longed for the days when the earth sang beneath him, 1,000 wild horses unshod. And unknown, in dreams he'll recapture the rhythm and rapture, the song of the nighthawk he'll softly repeat. Canción de Caballos, bajo las estrellas, to the drumming and jingle of unshod feet. The song of the nighthawk, an unshod. Now tempered to man's way, corralled by the day work and freed by the night. To run free of tether and lather-stained leather, spirits of broken and wild. Reunite. If he the nighthawk is what he'll repeat. Canción de Caballos, bajo las estrellas, to the drumming and jingle of unshod feet. The song of the nighthawk, an unshod. Flowing, no bits of steel glowing, flanks untouched by boot spurs, the herd thundered on. He longs to recapture the rhythm and rapture, the song of the nighthawk he'll sweetly repeat. Canción de Caballos, of unshod feet, the Sure.